Welcome to Declarations of War Podcast. This is episode 61. Thanks for tuning in. We are your hosts, Alexei Card, Ninja Turtle.
Hey, guys.
And CSM representative, Ali Aras.
Yo, what up?
Our special guest today is Insidious Empire head nerd, Freeze.
Hello!
Wow.
Okay. This is going to be an interesting one, folks. Ah, shoutouts! Shoutouts to Geno and Echo113 of Insidious Empire, who toughed it out with Noir and Sound in a really grueling 8-hour SOV grind operation. In particular, much love to Geno, who's been a fan of the podcast for over 2 years. So, keep listening, dude. We'll keep making them.
Send us money and we'll make more.
Ah, good point.
Turtle here, guys. I want to give another shout-out to Volta. It was a corp that was in Verge of Collapse for a long time. The one really awesome thing that I couldn't really tell anybody last podcast was where exactly they were going. So apparently one of their longtime members holds the key to an oh-so-famous alliance called Triumvirate, which you may remember from such corps as Doom, Omen, Burn Eden, Exceed Inc., like old school awesome. So they've reopened it up and are going to use it for their possibly nefarious deeds. So best of luck to them. It's cool to see such an old name back in business.
Now more versions of Tri than the Iron Man suit.
And before invasion of Pure Blonde.
This is Allie, and I'd like to give a shout out to, since Alex stole my shout out, to Geno and Echo113. Both those guys were totally boss. I would like to give a shout out to RVB and everyone who fit the ships for them. They had their event in which they did a massive free for all and blew up like 100,000 ships. Well, they had 100,000 ships. I don't know how many have been blown up at this point. And all of those were fit painstakingly by hand by a number of volunteers over the past months to make what sounds like it was an excellent and awesome event.
Freeze, you got any shout-outs?
I'd like to give a shout-out to the EMP ratting carriers that are dying on a minute-by-minute basis to Goon Black Ops. You're all scum and you should die. The EMP carriers, not Goon Black Ops. And I guess Jeff Raider, because he's Jeff Raider.
Yeah, he is pretty cool. If you see him, tell him to make more shit on Kugu. Because that podcast is awesome.
I think Doink is taking a little break. That's why there hasn't been one in a while.
Okay.
Before we get into our content, I want to give a shout-out to our sponsor, ETH Timecode. Buy 14 ETH Timecodes, get one free. ETHTimecode.com, where your business counts, and sadly, Alec doesn't have a decent referral link to cash out my character. So, speaking of which, we do have a lot to talk about in terms of Summer Blink, DNS Black, Poetic Stanzil, Nosy Gamer, all kinds of events and developments in the RMT side of the game. But before all of that, let's have you guys get to know our guest, Freeze, my nerdest of nerds.
Yeah.
How did you get started in EVE?
Star Wars Galaxies got shut down and I needed a new MMO to play. But my brother and I did the trial in 2006. Played for about an hour and a half, decided that this is the worst game that mankind had ever put together, and didn't play again for another 2-3 years.
Say, and then you resubscribed.
Yeah, I got sucked back in a few years later. My brother and his college roommate, he's actually the co-exec of my alliance right now, well, not co-exec, XO of my alliance right now, we're both playing it in their college dorm room, and they suckered me into it. And in about the first half hour of playing, they gave me a Caracal, which at the time was a big deal. And, I got a Kestrel. They were in a Caracal and an Osprey. They warped us in to do a mission or something, and I had one of them locked up, and instead of shooting the mission rats, I shot them, and we all got concorded because we were repping each other. And, my brother didn't talk to me for about 2 weeks because he was really, really mad about losing that Caracal. Big deal.
Those were the days.
The old days, right?
So I played a little bit in high sec, moved to 00 in Providence, started a corporation, started an alliance, attempted to invade Cloud Ring, got our ass handed to us, then joined Razor towards the tail end of the invasion of the North by Banner Brothers. And, did some stuff along the way.
So you were part of the Northern Coalition that ran unabashedly from Mercenary Coalition and all those guys?
Mm-hmm. That was a little bit before me, though. When I got there, and literally like the last week of the Max campaign. So people were talking about the Mercenary Coalition and what was it, the Insurgency and stuff like that. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Ah, okay. Max campaign invasion.
In fact, during Max campaign, for some reason I couldn't get my comms to work, so I was in the battles.
Does Max even qualify as an invasion? Like, that was kind of...
At the time, yeah, the NC were scared shitless.
Were they really?
Yeah.
Because they didn't take a single system, as I recall.
Yeah, they did. They took all of Veil of the Silent, all of Pure Blind, all of, or not all of, they took, like, key systems in Tribute. And that's where it ground to a halt, when they were trying to push into Tribute. This was the first one, not the second one. The second one was a crap fest and nothing happened.
That might be the one I'm thinking of. So many invasions in the north, hard to keep them all straight.
This was the one where Molly lost two Titans in like a week span, when losing a Titan was a really big deal.
That I do remember.
I think I was in one of those fights, but I couldn't get comms to work, so I was just wandering around in a Cerberus.
Did you whore on the Titan, though?
No, I didn't know what was going on. I just followed Fleet Warps and shot at things. I never even saw a Titan. I think halfway through I just logged off because I was bored.
Ha, bummer. So, talk about Insidious Empire. How'd you guys get started? What are you doing now?
After I got back from... Okay, more background. I've been with PL for about 3, maybe 4 years now. And I deployed to Afghanistan, came back, started playing with PL again, wasn't really interested, there wasn't much going on. And I got this idea in my head that I wanted to make my own alliance just because I was tired of taking crap from alliance leaders. And the idea was that we'd build an alliance revolving around myself as the FC so that I could do whatever I wanted in terms of FC decisions, fight who I want, etc. and so forth, and not have to deal with anyone else's crap. And when I started it, I took in most of, what the hell was that alliance called? TGA, something like that. Some crap-ass alliance in the HBC that was failing. I took 3 or 4 of their corps, formed like a 400-man alliance, basically just started picking through alliances that fail cascaded month by month, adding more people. And the goal was to try and take really not too great corps and turn them into at least decent corps. And it worked out pretty well. We got involved at the tail end of the HBC before Test reset them. And at that time, we were about 1,200-man alliance, decently competent. And with the Initiative and Unclaimed and a few smaller entities, we formed the Dinner Squadron, the short-lived coalition in Ketch, Impasse, Faithopolis, etc. and so forth. I fought a losing war of attrition versus Darkness and Despair and against all authorities for another 4 or 5 months. And despite all the other alliances except for the Initiative really dying around us, it seemed that that constant warfare actually helped our alliance build. We were able to absorb a lot of the people who were faltering around us. And at the tail end of the war, we came out a lot stronger than we had gone in. And decided to move up to Cobalt Edge because there's an opportunity there to take that space pretty much uncontested and work with Pandemic Legion again. And along the way, pretty much concurrently, Tess decided to fail Cascade entirely. And that same individual that I told you was my brother's roommate in college was a senior person in Tess. Maybe not in the direct hit, but at least in terms of personality. And he decided to come over to the Alliance and brought with him about 1,500 to 2,000 people. And delivering a pretty big blow to Test in terms of participation and stuff like that, and significantly augmenting what EMP's capabilities are. Before we got those guys, we could pretty much field 100 dudes, and now we can field about 350, so... At present, we're deployed with you Sons of Guns down in the Providence area, just kind of doing a little rapid deployment, shaking things up, trying to get some action.
Well, that part worked.
Yeah.
I would say so.
How are you guys enjoying the deployment so far?
The guys that have deployed are enjoying it immensely. The fucking bastards who are still in Cobalt Edge dying to Goon Black Ops and Radin Carriers, though.
Yeah, fuck those dudes.
Joke's on them, though, because we're actually going through and killing them ourselves now.
Ha!
They're a little irritated about that. Fire zone's open. Be aware.
All right, so this is a PvP podcast. Go into, let's say, your favorite thing to do in PvP, your favorite ship, and then the types of doctrines that your alliance likes to run.
Favorite ship? That's a tough one. Probably the Absolution.
The new one or the old one?
The new one.
Really?
The old one was cool, too. I like the new one more because you can get a lot of deeps out of it. You can actually roll with it as a fleet comp while also giving boosts. But favorite doctrine I have for EMP right now is the Brutix Doctrine, which has proved to be pretty damn successful. In fact, NC Dot is emulating it right now. They just started flying Brutix fleets yesterday. But yeah, it's
an interesting fleet.
It's nice.
Takes advantage of the recent rebalance to railguns. And I took a look at it in AFT. It's not bad. And I was trying to like picture how it would stack up against like shield artillery hurricanes. The tracking is way better, obviously.
The setting is way better.
But the thing is, you never see shield artillery hurricanes in large numbers in 0-0. It's designed to be a cheap, effective, ganky-ish boat that can punch above its weight in large fleet battles. And it does, because of that bonus to DPS. It does something like 618 DPS, about 57k EHP, which is not a lot. That's the only issue with it, is that you really have to dodge bombs, or a single squad of bombers is going to take you out. But yeah, I like it. It's probably the only original thing. Yeah, it's probably the only original thing that we've come up with as a doctrine, as an alliance, so I'm moderately proud of it.
That gets my nod. I guess we'll talk about all the details a little bit later on, but I've been on the receiving end of some bomb runs in that Brutix fleet. I wasn't in a Brutix myself, but yeah, I would like see the effect, and yeah, it's... The sig radius is large, the EHP is not fantastic, and especially when you've got multiple waves coming at you, it's like definitely a natural predator.
Yeah, you pretty much have to warp out or you're dead.
Tech 1 resists, too.
Yeah.
It's along the same lines as the sniper hacks of another age, that you need to be aligned, you need to realize when you're in danger and warp out yourself. The problem is that EVE pilots these days don't do that, they just sit there and die, not knowing how to protect themselves and their ship.
Yeah, McBarnacle.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this. One of our NOR Academy guys got caught in a tornado. Pretty badly. Got killed by a Navy comet and I think a wolf or something like that.
Oops.
Yeah.
That'll happen though. This T3 battlecruiser is exceptionally vulnerable to people getting under the guns.
And they're fucking paper thin too.
Yep.
Yeah. I was questioning their decision to try to insta-pop frigates, and I was right.
Yeah, they definitely don't track frigates well.
No, they don't.
They barely track cruisers well, for that matter.
You can try it, you just really have to be aligned and have a set of bookmarks, and if you don't, get the hell out of there.
You can do it with the Oracle, slightly easy, but you have to MWD away and keep range. If they get close, it's over.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea what range he was at, but I got the impression they burned for him, and he just sort of sat there.
Frigates are always going to be faster than your tier 3 battlecruisers, so once you see the frigate get within, like, 50 of you, that's time to get out.
Yep. Especially 50, because then they can sort of spiral in, and then you'll never track them.
I mean, at 50, you're never going to track them anyway.
Yeah. Alright, Freeze, well, thanks for coming on the podcast, and let's get right into the main bulk of the content here. We got poll results from our last episode. The question was, CCP's efforts to support community content generators. We got three answers. They should be doing more than they are, or it needs some tweaking, but they're generally going in the right direction, or CCP shouldn't be giving material support to any player or group, regardless of what they're doing for the community. It seems like the overwhelming majority think that the policy might need a little tweak, but CCP is generally in the right doing this at 70%, and pretty much equal numbers thought they should be doing more or shouldn't be doing anything at all, which signals to me that while there's a lot of stuff going on with Summer Blink in terms of controversy, it's not putting the community off to the general idea of CCP being involved and supporting people that are doing third-party apps and third-party services or podcasts or websites and things like that, and giving them some kind of in-game reward for doing so.
I think that's a good thing to hear, because I would be sad if CCP couldn't reward the people who are putting a lot of time into the providing third-party stuff, because for the people who are dedicating a lot of time to it, it really does, you know, start eating into, like, your playing time and other things, and it's fun. But getting that recognition, especially getting the recognition from CCP, is a pretty nice deal. I know I felt pretty good when they featured us as a fan site.
Yeah, until it crashed our fucking website.
Yeah, well...
But it was a good crash.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel like the way they went about it is such that all this controversy could have been avoided if they had been clear about what they were doing in the first place. They had just said, yeah, you know, Blink is doing such a good job. Here's X amount of faction scorpions or whatever. Go forth and conquer, nerds. And everyone on the page, there still would have been the same griping, like, well, why do they get one? Well, that's just because people are greedy idiots. But if they had not made it, I don't want to say under the table, because it's not like they tried to conceal it, they just didn't say anything about it either. And that's what caused the quote-unquote controversy. You always have people who are trying to jump onto CCP for the next, you know, T2 scandal or whatever.
Speaking of Summer Blink, Nosy Gamer, who writes a blog, has been doing some of the best sort of rational facts reporting on the Summer Blink RMT thing. He took a look at DNS Black's character auction. He took a look at some of the Summer Blink clones that have been popping up. And he took a look just today at their, or just recently, at their affiliate program. He emailed one of the guys from Shattered Crystal and found out exactly how much money Summer has made over the past, during the period when they were working with Shattered Crystal. And it's very interesting. About a third of Shattered Crystal's sales came through Summer Blink. And on those sales, Summer made $135,000. Which, you know, this is $135,000 over 2 years. So that's modest but livable salary, depending on where you are and whether anyone else in your family works. Certainly some of that did go back in to pay for the site infrastructure, so I have no idea how much profit there was off the top. But when we're talking about RMT, that's a fairly big number to put out there. And it doesn't make the whole, you know, Summer Blink is RMT thing any more comfortable. In addition, there's, like I said, there's all these clones that are popping up. You mentioned the DNS Black raffling off his character. Some guy named Poetic Stanzel is selling stuff on eBay. And that's all basically coming from the Summer Blink business model getting this publicity.
Well, I think Nosy Gamer revised his numbers down a little bit, but it's definitely non-trivial amount of money. And it's going to be something CCP needs to address.
Did he revise it down? I thought that wasn't an estimate. I thought that was actually a quote.
I believe that he mathed that out.
Okay.
And then got a bit of an updated thing, but it's still significant. Like nearly triple digits of money.
Yeah, it's even if it's not enough to live on, it's enough to get a part-time job on.
We'll FC for cash.
Right?
There's an interesting way of looking at it. Like, I'd never really thought about it that way, because you see the things where it's like, okay, well, for example, you can think of like Eve Timecode. They're our sponsor. You buy 14 timecodes and you get one free. But then, like, you start talking into transactions with third parties, getting stuff for, like, referrals, and it's, like, it's really confusing, but...
Nice plug, by the way.
Well, we'd already plugged him once, so it doesn't really matter. It was quickest example I could think of. And so, like, where's the line there? Because you're getting something, like, free, but I don't know. It's just confusing.
But it's not, I mean, it's not, I think the line is it's not an in-game thing. The thing that Summer Blink is doing is they're giving you back essentially an in-game thing in return for the Plex. There's, or in return for the GTC purchase. There was someone else who did that, and they... There was someone else who did that, and they had they just straight up gave you ISK. In Summer Blink, there's at least some facsimile of like a lottery, although you can certainly cash out by playing Blinks the right way, where the right way is to just buy out all the tickets, which is taking a loss for you. So you certainly do cash out. I don't think there's an issue with GTC people giving you, even giving you an extra DTC. That's an external thing that they paid for with money. And comes out of their bottom line. I don't think there's an issue with them or even with affiliates saying, here, you can get the special badge if you have a certain number of... if you've bought a certain number of GTCs, or you can get a t-shirt from us for free for doing it, or what have you. But the minute it starts being, you can get this thing in-game, that's where it goes off the hook a little bit.
Yeah, it's the whole situation seems to have gotten really out of hand. Like, the way that it's tying into the EULA and all that stuff. The whole thing with Summer Blink has sort of opened the Pandora's box of players going, well, if they can do it, then so can I. You've got Dirtnap Squad's leader, DNS Black, trying to raffle off his character for real money using the same loophole that Summer Blink was getting around. Poetic Stanzel eBayed his entire assets and then posted about him eBaying his entire assets, which... it's sort of a dick move by him, because now I'm sure CCP is going to take a look at that and reverse all the in-game transfers, which means the people that he sold that stuff to are basically got scammed in real life.
They can certainly dispute the charges on PayPal, and that means that Poetic will probably have a bunch of mad PayPal coming up his way.
I don't know, because they received the goods. Those goods were just then banned out of existence by the company. Kind of a gray area there.
Yeah, but PayPal tends to be pretty generous.
Cool.
I'm sure that it's probably more hassle than those people would want, though.
It's true.
Although I guess, you know, it serves them right for buying Eve stuff off eBay in the first place.
If they wanted Plex,
they could have just bought it.
Could have bought it on Amazon.
Did you see that fucking deal yesterday? Oh my god.
Yes.
I missed that. So mad.
Jared pinged me. He was like, hey, if you're looking for a way to pay for your hosting services, they're selling $5. I clicked it. I was like, oh, that's awesome. And then I went to, like, click the, get the this deal and a special ship. And then I clicked back to the original, and by the time I clicked back to the original, it was no longer available. My heart was broken.
Guess whose account is paid up for the next year and a half? Thanks, Amazon. Funny thing about that is people were talking about, like, some of the impact of the massive amount of Plex that got sold. So I know... some people, I think the deal was up for about 16 to 17 minutes, somewhere around that ballpark. And I know some people got upwards of 20, 30, 40 Plex for $5 for three of them, which is well, well below what they normally should cost. Doesn't CCP do, you can trade Plex for FanFest events and stuff like that?
Yep, you can frequently buy that stuff for Plex. The exchange rate tends to be pretty unfavorable. You're better off doing it just for real-life money. In terms of the actual EVE Online market, there was a slight drop in Plex prices, but it wasn't, you know, too long, and obviously it wasn't sustained. So Plex prices you'll still be able to get the same rather large amount of ISK for your Plex these days.
So, Allie, what's your read on what CCP's thinking with this? When you're close to the situation being on the CSM? Do you think they're likely to, you know, come out and say no affiliates? Are they likely to pull the third-party GTC program? Are they likely to go the complete other way and finally give in to the RMT side of things and say, okay, it's fine to take a scout for cash? How do you think it's going to play out?
That is so NDA'd, it is not even funny.
Just assume that it'll be the decision that makes the least sense and go from there.
Right. I mean, I don't have
Monocles.
To guess. I do not have to guess because the CSM is actually in these conversations now. And we're actually talking to CCP and discussing with CCP and hearing about the process as it goes on inside of CCP. But the side effect of that is I cannot speculate because I know and it's really NDA'd.
Fair enough.
So they should keep the CSM in the dark so you get entertaining podcast quotes.
I hope that whatever CCP does, they do the right thing and wire brush Poetic Stanzel's urethra. Just in general.
Gross.
Ow.
Yeah, that's...
Words
I feel like
can't
we should go
express.
To a commercial break after that one. We can just
Words
sit here in
express.
Silence.
That's as close as my feelings to Poe can come.
Yeah.
No, I like that he watches my League of Legends stream, but yeah. His entire career in EVE Online has been being an asshole, and he has finally cemented that by leaving EVE Online in the most asshole-ish way possible.
I really
it's okay,
want to know.
I plan on running for the CSM platform on the platform, or I'm planning on running for the CSM on the platform of being an asshole. Should go well.
So, I mean, James315 got there.
Yeah.
Well, almost.
But,
James315 chickened out from getting there.
That's... Oh, what was that, not a Burn Eden guy. What was that dude that didn't bother to campaign because he had alts and so many alliances that he would get reelected no problem?
Sounds like a solid dude.
Is this one of the previous CSMs, or is this...
No, I think this was 8.
This is the most recent one.
The Mitanni.
Are you thinking of, like, Greenlee is the only other repeat from previous
CSMs? No, not reelected, sorry. Just elected in the first place.
Travis Muskrat? Who else? I mean, there was whole...
It might have been Muskrat.
I thought Muskrat was,
He was also tracking Titans, didn't need to be nerfed.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, they didn't. You guys ruined that. You guys really fucked up. Don't worry, we'll undo it when we take over. Nomad.
Yes, I remembered it because I have it saved. His interview is just jaw-dropping.
With Xander?
Yeah. If you haven't gone and listened to Xander's... the host of Crossing Zebras put out a fantastic collection of CSM8 interviews. I don't know if they're still listed on the site, but... My three recommended, Sigurd Battersea, Travis Muskrat, and Fawn Revithort. Be the best 45 minutes you've ever spent.
I think if you're getting interviewed for a CSM election and you don't respond entirely from a Mitt Romney interview during the presidential election, you've failed the people.
I regret to inform you that I gave wide-eyed deer-in-the-headlights answers in my Crossing Zebras interview and did not once consult Mitt Romney.
Listen,
well,
people are going to vote.
That's why Jeff Rader's not your campaign manager. However, for a small fee, he can be for the next election.
Fair enough.
Actually, might not be a bad idea.
Well, Jeff, me, and Grath had this idea that for the next round of CSM elections that we are run it like exactly like a presidential election, just not actually trying to win, just trying to bring everyone else down with completely outrageous and unverifiable claims. And do so in, like, a kind of O'Reilly Factor-esque way with really, really
so
bad
fun.
Video productions.
And the phrase some people say a lot.
Yeah. Some people say Ali Aris wants to murder kittens. Is that who you want on the CSM? ... etc. and so forth.
Gotta use the phrase the American people. Often.
Obviously, we're gonna need a better, better voiceover guy.
Probably throw like something about Obamacare in there too, just to get everybody riled up.
Yeah, could be fun.
The CSM's attacking your freedoms.
Buy guns.
Yeah, I say go for it, because man. we could definitely use a little more excitement from the player side of the process.
It's one of those ideas that sounds good when you're talking about it on Mumble, and then when you try and do it, it's actually a lot of work, so you just give up and go back to playing Battlefield 4.
I wonder what all this, raffling off people's characters and that sort of thing is doing to the Plex market in general. I know the prices have been hitting a high lately. You think that could be behind it, or is it completely unconnected?
I think it's unconnected. They just announced a triple character training not that long ago. And there's still people playing the game. There's still a lot of, easy ways to make money that you can turn into Plex. I don't think that there's anything that would be keeping the Plex prices down.
Didn't the last round of participation statistics show that the game was trending downward since the last expansion? I remember seeing that somewhere.
I know I haven't logged in.
If that was true, I thought the last expansion was fantastic.
I mean, it made some good changes, but generally their numbers in terms of subscriptions only uptick when you do something that like has a lot of a lot of pizzazz to it. Like what was it back in the day? Not Empyrean Age.
Are you thinking of Apocrypha?
Either Apocrypha or Dominion. Probably Apocrypha.
I hate Apocrypha Dominion so much these days.
Oh god, Dominion sucked. Sucked so bad.
Dominion was awesome on paper, and then they decided that they couldn't put any of those features in the game, so they cut it down to about like a fifth of what they had promised.
It just happened to be the worst fifth.
Yeah. I was gonna say.
I'm still waiting for the in-game renter tools and treaties. What else did they promise in that one? It was a whole bunch of stuff that was really cool, and they were like, well, we're going to put this on the back burner for now, and you never heard anything about it again.
I did not realize they promised treaties in Dominion. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it was literally good to go. If you ask Celine about it sometime, he'll tell you all about treaties in Dominion.
I'm sure he will.
When I was in the CSM, the last thing that we heard about Odyssey was that response was pretty good in terms of subscription gains, but it's been a long time since initial launch. Maybe some of those people aren't staying around, who knows. We're getting ready for Rubicon, so
yeah. I know Retribution had a particularly long subscriber hang on, particularly because Retribution dropped and then Asakai happened. And then another interesting thing or two happened. And so that particular subscriber bump stuck around for a little while longer.
Need more interesting stuff to happen in EVE. It's not just devs.
Yep. Guys, jump your Titans into low-sec systems.
The interesting thing that's going to happen is they're going to kill the people who are carrier ratting and running in battleships in 0-0. You're going to have thousands of people unsubscribe in rage with the changes to the interdictors and the interceptors.
And you're going to have another 1,000 people, stay subscribed solely on the Plex value of all that loot that they scooped.
Possibly. Unfortunately, there's more people that stay in 0-0 to Care Bear than there are people that go out and actively hunt them. So I think that's probably a bad trade on their part. Not that I'm saying that those changes aren't good. I'm just saying that's what's probably going to happen.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, for everything there's a counter, and interceptors and interdictors are paper.
Nudable paper.
That too.
You assume that these guys know how to play EVE Online. The average 0-0 Care Bear does not. He goes, I'm tackled. Well, shit. And then explodes.
They take to the forums.
Yeah.
But, I don't care. Like, fuck those guys. Like, really, really fuck those guys. And that's the position that I had when I was in the CSM, too. Just do what's best for the game. Make it a better, more balanced, funner game. And whatever people you do happen to lose by nerfing whatever you had to nerf, or by a consequence of whatever you buffed being inconvenient for a certain subset of players, you will get that back with more people coming into a healthier, more stable game.
We're talking about a better balanced game. I'd like to get some more information on CCP about the T3 nerf that they're, quote, looking at, end quote. There's been no concrete information since they said that. And if you see right now, T3 is pretty much the easy mode winnable battle wagons of 0-0.
I have no information on that either, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard Pandemic Legion was doing great with T3s and 0-0.
I mean, they're taking dumb fights. Fighting 100 Zealots with 100 Proteuses isn't really a great... Well, I'm sorry, 100 Zealots with 30 Proteuses isn't a real great idea. So that's not really indicative of the ship as a class. The fact of the matter is when you're... I guess it's really a two-part thing. The first part is that bombers, as they are right now, are unbalanced. And when I say unbalanced, it means any idiot can hop into one with an MC that has half a brain and a probe launcher, and you can deny a fight for up to 500, up to 1,000 players with 25, 30 guys. And the limiting factor on that used to be is that when you tried to set up a bomb purchase, that everybody and their bombers would decloak each other if they were too close together. So you couldn't instantly get 50 people in system, have them work for purchase, and be able to daisy-cutter every single person on the field. You actually had to put some work into it, be there maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours in advance as the FC, get all your positions set up, and instruct people on how to bomb and tell them what to do. Now you don't need that. You just need 50 idiots to sit there and press F1. That's also how people can IS box bomber fleets of up to 20, 30 people. So you have a 0-0 battleground where bombers are king. If you're in anything that can be pinned down or has a less than average tank, you're going to die to bombers. And then you have the T3 flotillas with their exceptionally large EHP, their small SIG radius, who can pretty much take almost every bomb run, unless they really get walloped with like 50 or 60 bombers, something silly like that. Who also can do things like Black Legion Tengu fleet that can shoot from 200 kilometers away, is almost unprobable without an implant set, and cannot be bubbled, and has an align time of like 1.2 seconds.
But dies, like just looking at bombers.
No, actually. The only reason that they died to that bomber gang was because they warped to a planet where that bomber gang was already set up on accident, and they just turned and bombed at them.
And no, but I mean, what Turtle means is if they get hit by bombers.
Yeah.
Like if a bomber so much as sneezes in their direction before they warp,
but
then
they can't
they're
because
toast.
They can't be probed.
Well, this is like apples to oranges. We're assuming the FC is good and keeping them on fleet, but if you put them in front of bombs, they will not take the damage of those bombs. You're not asking like, is the FC going to keep them out of the way?
Sure, but the counterpoint to that is that it takes 10 seconds for a bomb to impact on a ship, and a ship that can't be bumbled, and that has an align time of 1.2 seconds.
And it really is hard to probe these things down. I know because Sound and NMG tried pretty ferociously during one of the Providence battles to get a warp in on the Black Legion Tengu fleet, and even when we almost got one, they were pretty fast. They moved right out of the way. So...
The fact of the matter is that a T3 does everything that an armor hat can do, but better, and with gimmicky modifications to it. And that's not what CCP originally intended with the class. And whether or not that's how they want it to continue is, you know, up to them. But at the moment, there's no reason to fly an armor hack or a heavy assault class vessel in the first place if you can fly a T3.
And the ship class in particular is kind of weird because it occupies somewhat different spaces in 0-0 fleets versus wormhole space, where there are the PvP meta has all these considerations that 0-0 FCs don't even take into account. So it's a particularly delicate balance job.
I'm not terribly miffed about it, to be honest, because you got to keep in mind the ships cost a boatload of money. I mean, you're talking about an armor hack fully fitted out. It's like, what, 200 to 250. These ships are 500 to 750. If you're going to put money in them, it could be even more than that. And you lose skill points if you die in it. And it's not like Black Legion Tengu fleet doesn't have a counter. If you flew 250-kilometer Nagas, you would pop, like, Tengu for Naga. Naga costs, what, 150 million tops?
Yeah, and you die to a single bomber, and you can be probed, whereas they cannot.
Yeah, but you can warp off just like they can warp off.
So that's not a counter, that's just two fleets warping away from each other.
Well, that's a counter for the Tengus, but if you want to throw bombers into the mix, then...
Well, that's the problem, is that with the current mechanics, bombers will always be in the mix. And when you have a 0-0 where every single entity is stagnating and sending all of their people to Curse and Providence because there's no content whatsoever, that's going to happen. So every big fight, no matter where you are, is going to get gangbanged by 50 to 100 bombers from NTs that really don't give a shit about what's going on. So I see what you're saying, and it makes sense, but you have to factor bombers into every engagement now, so...
Yeah, there's a part of me that sees what you're saying and sees what other people with similar concerns are saying. And this is a conversation that, you know, we're having on the CSM as well as outside. But there's another part of me that's appreciated being able to have bombers and even being able to have them as an option for entry-level pilots and for a group that's smaller but still wants to be, you know, useful and productive. So if you, you know, if you make bombers so that they're the only, a pilot has to be, you know, very experienced in order to not completely fuck everything up, you run the risk of just drawing on the same people who should be out there in their, you know, in their Tengus or whatever.
Well, I think it's definitely better now than it was. The best solution would have been give people in your same fleet the ability to see each other while they're cloaked, but that was considered too coding intensive, so they just made it if you were cloaked, you couldn't decloak anyone else that was cloaked. And even with that, you still have some people that just can't do good bomb runs, which is... It's definitely a skill, even if most of the skill is in the FC, even the execution. There's some level of pilots needing to know how to line things up and warp out so they stay alive, time everything, not decloak ahead of time. There's all kinds of stuff that can go wrong. I think the issue isn't really with one wave of bombers or even two waves of bombers. I think the issue comes in when you see several waves of 3, 4, 5 full sets of bomb runs going off in the same target. And it has a bit of the old Titan Doomsday effect of discouraging certain types of fleets. Which, in turn, as Freeze mentioned, sort of screws up the balance meta of EVE.
Here's the thing.
That's where I think the issue is.
If you want to look at a comparable issue, look at the Titan the tracking nerf of XL guns. Because you had 30 or 40 people in Titans for the large alliances like Pandemic Legion who could jump into 1,000 battleships and kill all of them. Completely, I don't want to say risk-free, but it was pretty much assured that you were going to kill a lot of shit at very little risk to yourselves. And CCP wanted to do away with that, because they didn't want 30 or 40 people dictating 1,000-man fleet fights and whether or not they happened. Well, now you have the exact same thing in bombers, it's just that everyone is on the side of it because they enjoy hopping into a bomber and being one of those people. But if you're not in the bomber fleet, and you have 1,000, and you're in the 1,000-man subcapital fight, you're trying to get a subcapital fight, you're kind of screwed because you either have to warp out for 20 times over the course of the next hour and a half, or you're bombed off the field in the first 10 seconds, and it's over. And when you say ship types that are vulnerable to bombers, that is every single ship type except for T3s.
I throw armor hacks there and assault frigates and the not vulnerable to bombers.
Wow, if you're in an assault frigate fleet in a large fleet fight, you're not really doing much anyways.
Well, yes, but perhaps one tool could be make assault frigate fleets more compatible for fleet fights by giving them better anti-logistics tools and more rep capability for themselves. Like, they sort of touched on that with the T1 logistics frigates, but there are other options as well. But going back to the Tech-3s, in future balancing, it sounds to me like you have less problem with Tech-3s than you do with bombers.
I have a problem with elements of the game that make large-scale 0-0 fights not conducive to actually happening. And the T-3s and the bombers both accomplish that. One with the gimmicky setups you see where you can come in at 200 kilometers and not get tackled and not get shot, etc. and so forth. Or on the flip side of that, you can... Well, no, actually, really, it's only that, because even the larger tank T3s, you're still vulnerable to a lot of stuff. And then the other side of that coin is the bombers, where you can have 50 people shut down an entire grid for 1,000 people. And one of the big drawing points to EVE Online is the large-scale 0-0 fights. So, if CCP wants to actually have those continuing and have people drawn to them, they can either decide on whether or not it's cooler to have 50 dudes shut down a battlefield with bombers, or whether it's more fun to have 1,000 people in battleships in armor hacks and T3s wailing on each other over the course of 3-4 hours, not being on grid for 10 minutes and then one entity gets bombed off the field and it's over.
Well, it sounds pretty easy when you say it like that, but...
Oh, it's absolutely not, easy.
It's not that easy to coordinate a large-scale bombing run.
It's retardedly easy. You get four or five bookmarks on grid in different positions so that when the daisy cutter comes in, it comes in an angle of up, down, left, right, and then whatever other angle you can mix in there so that the bombs don't overlap. You get everyone to sit in those positions. It takes about 5 minutes, and then when the enemy lands, you probe and fleet warp before their bubble comes up. It works every single time. The only issue there is whether or not you know how to probe.
Speaking of large fleet fights, there was one.
Yeah!
An epic trap to sort of pay back the Black Legion trap, I presume, for the Revenant that they baited in and killed. Pandemic Legion set up a very, very elaborate piece of bait to draw out Black Legion's capital fleet. And they did better than that. They managed to get out the super capital fleet. And we had probably the largest battle since Asakai. And it was fun, man. Definitely fun. I think the total death count for the super caps is, what, 23 motherships?
I think it was more than that. Hold on.
Might have been a few more.
I think it was something like 28. 28 or 29.
So the setup is, a Pandemic Legion member managed to get a old AAA alt corp to rent in one of the new renting alliances down in Impasse, and constructed a situation whereby he tackled a Pandemic Legion Titan, and then called in Black Legion to come kill it. And when Black Legion did, Pandemic Legion half-heartedly jumped in some repping ships, which caused Black Legion to escalate, and then Pandemic Legion just dropped the hammer and brought in, it felt like brought in everybody. I know that the CFC wasn't there in huge numbers, but you had Nully there, you had NC Dot was there, Insidious Empire was there, the AAA guys, and pretty much the entirety of Stainwagon was there.
It was an interesting fight because it really revealed a lot of things in terms of how things might go down if and when World War III, which is the unofficial moniker of the brewing CFC versus N3 conflict, has been in my alliance, and that you saw Razor and AAA in Darkness of Despair on the field, but they weren't on the field taking advantage of both sides or trying to focus on, you know, getting some kill bans. They were on the field specifically to help Black Legion Capitals extract. And you have that sort of behind-the-scenes, wink-wink, nudge-nudge with Black Legion, the CFC, and perhaps maybe even some Southern elements in terms of not wanting to deal with N3 and trying to foil their objectives. So it was interesting. In fact, one of the bullet points that most people miss is that one of the reinforcement convoys of PL Capitals was actually ambushed by a small dread force from Razor Alliance, as well as some unions. The problem was is that they were dropping on a capital convoy, which quickly sounded in more capitals, and they lost more dreads than they killed by a significant number. Yeah, it was a good fight, though. I had fun.
I had fun, too. I was actually able to get there, which was cool, because we were deployed with the MP in the SA. It was, I found out that it was going down through somebody in Black Legion, actually. And then, gotta go, and managed to, I think I caught the first Titan through, and then the rest of the route that you guys went was through, jump bridges and Titans that we weren't blue to, so I actually had to slow walk 30-something jumps in 0-0, about half of that through 10% tie-dye, just to get into the fight.
Yeah, tie-dye was brutal on that one.
Oh, it was horrific. And it wasn't just for that system, too, it was five systems leading up to it. And randomly throughout that entire route, you would run into a system that had two people in it, 10% tie-dye.
Pandemic Legion forgot to reinforce the node.
Well, honestly, most of us didn't think that it would work. there were so many elements of setting up that gank that were slapdash and haphazard. Like the first thing was is that one of the key people in it, who was supposed to be in a bait carrier so that we could doomsday the bait carrier, slept through his alarm clock and didn't wake up. So we had to lie and say that, oh, well, he tried to doomsday me and he missed, but I warped out, but I still got him tackled, which immediately sounds like something sketchy. Let's see, there was the mumble overlay on the screenshot that we used to lure them in. If you look at the screenshot of the Titan being tackled by the quote-unquote AAA citizens Dictor, you can see MVN Super Spy Bob over on a mumble overlay in the top middle of the picture, which to anyone who knows the corp names in Pandemic Legion, that would tell you, like, well, what's up with this?
Right.
And then the actual organization of it between the FCs occurred on PL OG Mumble, which pretty much anyone can access. And, like, two or three waffles jumped in and asked us about if we wanted to play a video game or something like that. And waffles are a well-known source of spies within PL and the PL community anyway, so there's a lot of elements that said there's no way that these guys are going to fall for it. Mature shit, they took the bait.
Do you know what prompted the decision from Black Legion to go for a super capital drop instead of the dread op that you were expecting?
I have no idea. I know that they had used super capitals like a day or two earlier to nuke a bunch of Nully and N3 caps and LoSec. I think it was the super capital instead of the dread fleet. No, I don't know what they chose to do, but honestly, I would have rather have killed the Dreads than the Supercarriers. I know the ISK value, when saying that, the ISK value seems insane, but Black Legion's Dread Fleet is more of an issue than their Super Capital Fleet.
Yeah, but it's also much easier, much more easily replaced. You kill all those Dreadnoughts, they can get that, but taking out the Super Capitals, even if they have the ISK to replace it already, which I'm quite sure they do, like, it's more time intensive to try to get super capitals back.
Well, the rumor is, and I say rumor because it's definitely a shaky rumor, is that Solar Fleet will be setting them up with reimbursements for all the super capitals that they lost. Again, shaky rumor. I'm not putting any faith behind it.
I would love to see Solar come up with like 30 supers that they don't need.
eBay.
Buy one from Poetic Stanzel.
Who? Never heard of him.
Just dip into the PayPal renting account.
Right. That was good. I was glad that I was able to go there, even if it was somewhat short-lived. Me and another Nord director were the only people from Nord that actually successfully made it down with all the tie-dye and the roadblocks getting up there. But we had fun. We did not survive. We were killed by... I was killed by Nully. I forget who got Peppy. Yeah,
there's a lot of blue Stanex issues on that one, I think. And some random N3 alliance shot Ash in our fleet, and we ended up killing like 40 of them in retaliation.
Of Sound Mind, the people that Of Sound Mind got down there, I got killed on the way in. Worse, just straight up primaried by an Nully fleet. You can see it in one of their videos.
Sounds
guys,
about right.
We have 30 super capitals tackled. Let's shoot the shit-fit Tekwan ships.
Yeah.
They don't have Black Legion tags, sir. What? Lock. Primary. Go. What about these Black Legion Moonins over here? No, no, no. Kill the Moas.
Or that makes sense.
It's very important that you shoot the random subcaps.
Gotta get those kill mails.
Mm-hmm.
You never know, one of them might be an interdictor in disguise.
So, speaking of Providence, let's get right into it. The contract wrap-up. No contracts to speak of because we've been on campaign in Providence, although we will have a contract to talk about on the next show. We've been hired for Nightmare New Eden, which is a Halloween event. It should be a hell of a lot of fun. It's sort of like Bring Me the Head of Kirith Kodachi, except instead of a carrier, it is appropriately a nightmare. And Nar has been hired to be the security force, along with the rest of the defense fleet, which we will hopefully be organizing. So it should be quite a fun event, a good way to celebrate Halloween. But before that, Providence. Lots and lots of Providence. As we hinted at on the last podcast, we were on campaign in Providence. We are attempting to take the station in 9UI. And, yeah, things blew up, like... I mean, I knew, because of everybody that was deployed to Curse, that as soon as anything went down anywhere in the south, people would be all over it, and this was no exception. But I definitely underestimated the sheer level of interest this campaign would generate from literally everyone who's anyone in 00 made an appearance. Solar was there, CFC was there, Black Legion was there, Darkness of Despair, AAA, various parts of Stainwagon, various Renners. You guys were deployed with us as sort of our heavy hitters. Pandemic Legion was around. I mean, anybody that was anybody, because no one's doing anything. So
exactly. That's depressing part, is that all of 00 crams itself into one fight because there's nothing going on in the rest of 00.
And we were estimating that fully, like, 25% of local was in a bomber.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Case, you guys, well, that gives some context to why I'm super butt-mad about the bombers, because I was leading one of the large fleets, and I did lose a lot of ships to bombers, which was mostly because of a bad warp-in on myself, so I'm not really miffed about that. I'm more miffed about the fact that, as they said, there's 250 people in bombers in local from 4 or 5 different alliances that are ostensibly based in regions that are nowhere even close to where this fight was occurring. And you can do that and take advantage of large fights like these and shut them down entirely for the people who are trying to have a battle and et cetera and so forth, you know, blow ships up.
I mean, I think the only saving grace of that was that the bombers spared no anus. You know, both sides were getting bombed pretty significantly.
Yeah, so, that's true.
At least the pain was shared, but yeah, it did get a bit annoying. I mean, we were in bomber fleets for the most part. I say we, I mean Noir and Sound. And it sucked because neither of our alliances is as experienced as everybody else involved in bombing in that kind of massive 00 fleet fight environment. So we were probably the slowest bomber squads on the field, except for maybe CVA, and even then some of the CVA bomber squads are quite good. And yeah, it sucked because we would line up runs and then someone else would bomb and that fleet would warp off and then we'd be like, ugh. We'd have to wait and warp out, get new runs. It's just really annoying. It's too many cooks in the kitchen kind of thing.
It's also just with all the people in bombers cloaked up, I was looking around for a fleet to bomb. And I'm like, well, all right, we have the Black Legion Tengus who are unbombable. We have CVA, who's hiding in their POS. It was their system, which they were ostensibly defending. And for 2 straight timers, they spent the entire time in the 9UI jump bridge POS.
Just, POS that keeps on giving.
Yep. They were just chilling and sitting inside the shields and doing jack all to save their system. While pretty much the rest of 00 fought around it. So you've got CVA in their POS, you've got Black Legion in their Tengus, you've got Insidious Empire and PL, who are blue, and then...
Oh, blue-ish.
Well, Insidious Empire and PL, whose FCs will get butt mad at me if I bond them. And then you've got, like, that left... one Russian fleet, maybe, to try and line up on. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. In terms of the actual fleet fights, the first day's timers were defended by CVA amongst others, and they were in the battleship fleet. And then they lost the entire battleship fleet, I believe at your hands, Freeze. And then they never came back to battleship
familiar.
Since.
Sounds familiar.
They learned that one faster than they did in the previous Providence engagement, in which they came back in battleships until they ran out of battleships.
They're not intelligent at EVE Online. I've always marveled how an alliance and a coalition that has been in 00 for so long and has been a bit player at most, but a player nonetheless, just has never figured out the basics of how to play the game. Really, the only thing that they've come close to is that they kind of know how to drone assist, maybe, unless you kill their drone assist and then they just sit there and die. and they kind of know how to bomb, maybe, but they never use a dictor, so if you warp out, you're never going to get caught.
And yet, somehow, we're losing.
Oh, well, we're losing because AAA and Darkness and Despair blew them up in the last timer and killed all the SBUs. So well, that
yes,
the real revelation, not that it's a surprise for anyone who's been in 0-0, but if you're a Providence duder who's sitting there marveling at the stalwartness of CVA, is that, no, guys, you're AAA pets. And AAA is pretty bad these days, so that's saying something.
They also had Black Legion coming in carriers to rip their iHub, which was the clutch moment for the first day of timer.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reason we didn't get the iHub shield timer was because Black Legion decided that carriers were necessary.
But no one was going to drop on Black Legion because it's Black Legion, so they wrapped it up uncontested, and then of course we would come back and do the timer anyway. So we kept on getting these timers, never really able to push it super far because one entity or another would come to CVA's rescue.
We had the station to armor timer, and we had the iHub coming out
almost
of shield, and it
armor
wasn't
timer.
Almost to armor timer, yeah.
Yeah, Noir and Soundmind together on the last day of the fighting when we lost all the SBUs. Someone in our Skype channel where we share with EMP and Ashes and a whole bunch of other people, we're like, yeah, put up more SBUs, let's do this thing. I'm like, all right. So we did it, and we sat bombers, assault frigates, and a few other things to try to keep it safe. And we got some fights, but nothing huge. Mostly just 3 hours of sitting around. And meantime, CVA repaired the station, but they did not, for some reason, repair the iHub at all. So the iHub was sitting at 18% shields, and as soon as the SBUs were re-anchored, we were like, alright, let's go for this iHub. Let's get a timer for the weekend US time zone. Came in there, pew 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 pew, over the course of about 5 to 6 hours. We managed to get it from 18% shield to 54% armor with like a 15-man fleet, 20-man fleet. And then AAA and Severance fleet turned up, pushed us off it, and started killing the SBUs again.
Oops.
At which point we were like, fuck it.
Yeah, we had... We couldn't get the numbers. We were losing people, and their people were logging on.
Yeah, at that point it was like, what, 6 in the morning?
It was more like 4 in the morning, but yeah. Oh, I guess you mean an eve.
I don't know. Well, either way.
It was like 4 in the morning local
well
time.
Well after all our bedtimes. Especially considering the day's festivities. So we had 20, it started dropping down, we finally were at 15, and CVA was getting more people, and it was starting to come into the Russian prime time, and they're like, we're done. So we pulled the fleet back out, and managed to catch a fight on the way. The AAA cruiser fleet pursued us to G5, and as soon as we jumped into the Sinojam system, we turned around and took them on and managed to get the win there. But at that point, it was the entire fleet was just at its wit's end, all ready to go to sleep. So we managed to get out and called it for the evening. And that's where things stand right now, aside from a op we have tonight, which should be interesting.
Ah, shit, I forgot about that.
Oh, come on, man. It's going to be like the highlight of my evening. How could you forget?
Oh, it's man, that's in like 6 hours, too. Ugh.
Oh, I can't wait.
Not going to work on time tomorrow.
Yeah, we had, since this won't be airing till well after the op, we have reinforced a Providence CSAA that we believe something is in build with, because it was offline the last time we scouted it, and now is online. In fact, there's two of them cooking things, we presume. And that should be fun.
Hopefully, unlike the last time... Well, last time we had one of these, Providence had a CSAA that was offline the last time we scouted it, online. And the builders in the CSAA, or the CSAA owners, claimed to Providence leadership that it was empty. We killed it and it dropped cap parts, which were obviously just from the fleet hangar or whatever.
Just building parts, friends. Just building parts.
Yep. So,
nothing to see here.
And I'm interested to see what the response to the CSA will be. Hopefully the people who own it are slightly more honest about the contents.
Well, I'm interested to see if we get more than 12 dudes in fleet in a really terrible time zone, so we'll see how that goes.
I'll be there.
Alright, that's one.
Me and at least one other person will be there.
Four.
Let's see. I'm looking for attendees and fleet up. Oh, look, that is just me. Never mind. So, down to three, but that's alright.
I'll come with you.
Fight with the strength of 10 men.
Ooh, I have a low sec exit. I could totally, or a high sec exit. I could totally come.
You totally should, Dorval.
What are you flying?
Shield Verdicts.
Probably. I don't know.
Well, Verdicts is oracles, I'm sure. We've given EMP a lot of shit over the past week for their fleet doctrines. The Shield Verdicts are really fun, but it's literally all they do. So every time somebody comes on my comms, they're like, because one of the things that we do in Noir, the first thing people do when they come in is like, oh, what ships do we need? What ships do we need? So they're always, every time an op gets posted, and like I just leave the doctrine thing blank, and then I'll always get somebody who'll be like, Alec, what kind of fleet are they running? What ships? What ships are we bringing, Alec? I'll give you one guess. It's probably going to be something in shields, guys.
Hell yeah.
Hasn't changed for the past week. Stop asking, please.
I see that your alliance and my alliance are demonstrating similar levels of curiosity about doctrine.
Oh, that was nothing, though. The best one was the where are we staging thing. I wanted to throw my head through a door. I swear to God, the entire day, this is like on day 5 of the campaign, one after the other, after the other, after the other, people logging on were like, where's the fleet leaving from, Alec? Where are we forming up at? Where's the fleet? It might be in Asa, where we've been for a week.
Same thing we do every night, Pinky.
I wanted to do the Homer Simpson joke. But good times. So we're still around in Providence, and we'll see what these guys do tonight, and who knows what the future holds. But the campaign's not over yet. I'd be sort of embarrassed if we got sent home packing by CVA after one try.
To be fair, got sent home packing by Stainwagon and BL, who apparently have decided to, you know, adopt CVA. Local stray Providence.
It's like the little Downs kitten you just can't leave outside.
Exactly.
Drown it. Sorry.
And it's not like, should this campaign be successful, it's not like CVA will have nowhere to live or nowhere to go. It's not like we're planning on evicting them out to Losec like some careless people in their history. We just want a little bit more content in the region.
Yeah, it's not an existential threat to CVA.
Although posting that it is certainly, you know, helps their fleet numbers, so good for them.
Yeah, the sky is falling, right?
Absolutely.
Alright, moving on. This week in Mercs, we actually have nothing interesting to talk about, because apparently Noir is the only mercenary that did anything of importance or fun this week. So, if you are a mercenary unit listening to this, and you are doing something that's interesting, and we just don't know about it, please mail your story over to Alexei of Card, and we will talk about it on the podcast. Mercs.
I think we gotta figure out how this message is being disseminated now. Is this a message that is going out in, like, Merc Contracts channel for submissions?
A couple of guys in Merc Contracts listen to the show regularly.
Well, it's good to know that we have at least, like, 2 listeners, but...
Are you implying I should go out of my way and do more work to try to get stories? That's what I thought. I'm kidding. Yeah, I'll send out a reminder to the Merc Contracts guys, but, you don't have to be a Merc Contracts manager to talk to the podcast. If you're one of the grunts or directors or FCs, and you were involved in something cool, there's an interesting development with your alliance, or you guys took a really awesome contract, these are the kind of things that we want to know about and feature them on the podcast. Moving on to the CSM. Siphons. CCP has finally put out more information about them.
Fucking terrible.
Yeah, I'm a little underwhelmed as well. Admittedly, I wasn't set up to be fully whelmed in the first place.
Yeah, they're kind of interesting. Moongoo is... There's a couple of challenges, one of which is that Moongoo is relatively slow income. So if you're going to have to spend anything to put one of these down, it's going to take a little while before you're able to actually get stuff out of it again. You can go get stuff out of it, but it's going to take a while before that's actually worth anything.
I don't know if that's exactly true, though, because they're talking about the small ones being in the ballpark of 10 million ISK, and that's fucking nothing. You can make that back, like, on an R64 real quick.
On an R64, yeah, but you have to find an R64 first.
Hey, guys, you know what'll make POS managers really want to do their thing? If the entire reason that they have a POS up gets taken away, and they have to check their POS every hour on the hour for a siphon.
That was going to be my next thing, is that the idea of being able to interdict someone's AFK income is great. Unfortunately, it is right now, the implementation is such that you're interdicting AFK income with more AFK interdicting. Like, if I discover that there's a siphon on my POS, I've already lost 20%, maybe as few as 10% of my goods, just lost to waste. I can't ever recover that. And someone can log on and do this while I am at work, while I am asleep, while I'm doing any of the other stuff that I normally do in my real life that is not log on to EVE Online. I could get my corp to go ping my POSs and check them, but my corp only has 250 bookmarks. A subject which I brought up with CCP. So there's not a lot of really compelling sort of tit for tat, or, you know, someone comes in and they just drop something that's not a lot of effort, and then it makes my life about a million times worse. So that's why I don't really like the siphons as they are implemented. There have been some really good suggestions. Pulling together, I think, a couple of the ones that I've heard that I really like. There's been a suggestion to make it so that the siphons only have any waste when you take from them. So if someone discovers a siphon on their POS and blows it up, they get all their stuff back without having to worry about it.
Cool, well, so you're still going to have everyone... What are you going to do? Have a guard shift for checking your POS?
I'm not done yet.
Okay, that's cool.
That's the first part. So if you check your POS...
If you haven't been able to tell.
I mean, so am I. If you check your POS, you actually get something back for doing that. Like, that's not just check it and then become depressed. The other idea I liked was one where if someone actually steals from a siphon, it notifies you. So if you're willing to take the risk that someone has put a siphon on your POS, you can find out about that. You don't have to log in to find out about that, but in exchange, you're going to lose some money. If you log in, you can recover all your money. If you don't log in, you don't have to check it, if you don't mind taking a little bit of risks.
Okay, so, what were you guys expecting out of these things? Because, I mean, the way that, they don't really...
Something that made sense.
They don't really seem like all that fucking crazy OP. It kind of sucks that you have the waste factor when you're pulling it out of the POS, but, the thing's not that big. It's only going to hold 1,200 M3, and at 60 units a pull, well, what the moons pull, the moon miners will pull 100 units, so you're stealing just over half, but 20% of that is then lost. So you end up getting about like a little less than half of what's actually being mined out of the pods. But a 1200 M3 capacity on an R64, that's like less than 24. That's like 20 hours worth before it's full. So I mean,
and you can pick it up with a blockade runner in 10 seconds. Whereas
and
if you want
put it
to
down.
Defeat exactly. Whereas if you want to defeat the siphon, you have to have someone checking at that moon every hour on the hour. Or they can just keep putting them over and over again because they're going to cost 10 mil.
And they can put them on every single moon in an entire region. And that's gonna cost you money. That's going to take away from your moons. I'm not even considering these from the perspective of someone who's running a tower 3 regions away. I think, forget the people who are running a tower 3 regions away. This is something that's designed to, or the idea behind these was to make it harder to do that, or at least riskier to do that.
Is a half-baked Dominion concept. This is one of those things that they were talking about in Dominion, where they wanted to encourage small gang PvP and people living in their space by question mark. These are the half-baked concepts that they're resurrecting to try and do that. The problem is that this doesn't cause PvP, it just causes logistics people to slit their wrists.
Yeah, exactly. More than logistics people are already likely to slit their wrists.
Mm-hmm.
So,
is that like a question of is the way that we have? Okay, so you look at a group like Pandemic Legion, for example. They're going to have R64 moons spread out from the north is north to the south is south. Like anywhere they can find an R64 and take it from somebody that's not going to fuck with them, they're going to take that R64. Like, is that overarching concept of holding a moon in every fucking corner of the galaxy? Like, is it supposed to be like that? I think that's the first question.
But that's not what the siphon is here to. Well, that maybe that's what the intention was with the siphon, but in actuality, it will fuck every single person who holds a moon. Not whether or not you live 3 regions away or whether you live 1 jump away. If you're not checking your moon every hour on the hour, you're going to lose ISK. Without any notifications, without any risk really to the person putting it down, since it costs 10 million.
And it's not creating, and it's hard to do something that's going to create a small gang PvP environment if there's no way to really find out it's there. Like, someone warps and they were talking a little bit in, I think, the dev blog about, like, asynchronous gameplay, and I can kind of understand that. But there's nowhere in this asynchronity is there a way to also find out, like, alright, when is someone coming to pull from the siphon? When is someone, you know, generally putting these things down? Whereas if you had the API and notification alerting you when someone took from your siphon, you would have more of an idea that something was happening, and you'd be more likely to get out there and try and fuck up whoever it was taking your stuff. And that's the last part of ideas I've heard that I'd want to implement. And this one is a buff, not a nerf, to the siphons. Make them untargetable by POS guns. So basically what you have then is you have something that if you find it, you can take it out and recover 100% of what could have been lost because you logged on more than the other guy did, or because you had your alliance mates patrolling it, or because you were more on top of your stuff than he was.
Sign me up for POS patrols.
Maybe that's how it's supposed to be.
Sounds exciting.
Though.
Yeah, great.
I mean, that sounds like...
That's not content. That's mindless shit.
So is dropping a tower on every R64 you can find and hold and coming back to it once a month to fuel it and dump out the silos, like, is that content?
No,
and everyone already knows that the POS system is terrible. Making it more terrible by having active people having to sit there and go, well, did anyone fuck with it today? No. All right, I'm going to go get a sandwich and check again and again and again and again and again. That's not content either. That's just stupid.
Yeah, and Turtle, it's not just affecting every single... It's not affecting just every single R64 or even the one that's 3 regions away. It's affecting... This is something that would have driven me fucking nuts as a person managing POS, living in Pravi, managing a POS in my system in Pravi.
like, I guess the one assumption there is that people are going to be all spellbound to drop these on, like, R16 moons and stuff, and I don't think that's going
to
be the case.
There's no reason why not to, because you can drop this on an R16 moon, and you can use it as a griefing tool. If for 10
yeah, they're
million,
cheap enough.
Yeah, for 10 million.
That's the issue.
Is
if, they were,
the
if there was any investment whatsoever, if there was any investment in time or effort or ISK into putting the siphon down, then yeah, I could see it being at least somewhat more justifiable. But if it costs 10 mil, and you can make, I don't know, what's the... I'm not going to do the math, but say you put it on the highest income R64, and you make, say, 300 mil out of it, and then you can do that over and over and over again, because
well,
you can keep defeating the people. I'm not saying that's the actual amount, I'm just completely bullshitting that offhand.
Well, the actual amount's important, though, because, I mean, that's your return is what's going to dictate, like, is the risk worth it or not. I mean,
there is no risk.
The math is easy. Well, okay, the investment, maybe not the risk, the investment of time and resources and, like, finding the moon and putting it down. Because, like, the math is really easy. Find the highest value R64, multiply the unit price by 1,200, and that's how much the full small
thing is going to be. But here's the
thing
which you're not thinking about is that it's not just about making ISK. It's about using it as a griefing tool to deny ISK to others. What this is going to do is it's going to have three or four people with blockade runners and siphons are going to go into an entire region and hit all the R64s and do it over and over again.
And the R32s and the R16s and the reaction
bosses. And do it over and over
bosses.
Again because they are motivated to take down an entire alliance's income, and you will have to check every single tower that you have over and over again. So again,
good.
That goes that... Okay. Well, you're fucking retarded.
I'm all for the fucking griefing part of it, dude, to be perfectly honest, because I think there's absolutely no reason that large alliances should be able to hold moons uncontested 4, 5, 6 regions away from them and, like, show up once every week, once every 2 weeks to just dump the silos. Like,
but
I think that is
still,
fucking retarded.
You can still grief with a less retarded version. Like, you can still grief with a version where recovery is possible. You know, the only way, when I'm talking about, like, something that's sending you notifications or whatever, I'm saying it sends you a notification after you're already fucked. So you put something down when you pull out of it. So when you take their stuff, they're alerted to that. If they are not logging on and checking it, then they're just going to keep getting their stuff stolen. In a worse situation where someone wants to interdict all of someone's moon production, they put all these down on their posses. They come back, they siphon periodically, they, you know, they pick it up, they deploy new ones for the ones that got popped, whatever. They're still going to get 50 to 100% of an alliance's income if they work at it. And they
don't have to
work that hard.
How are they getting 100%? Because the most they're ever going to be
able
to drop is 6/10.
You can drop two. You can drop two siphons on a pause, and they will both siphon. So and you can just keep stacking them, I think.
Hang on, I need to check that, because I thought I read you can only drop one in a pause.
You can do at least two, maybe more. So you can use that to pull out more stuff. You also can't, one of the other things from the post where I stole the, you know, 100% return thing, you can't pick which goo what kind of stuff the POS steals. So if you have something that mines an R64 and sends it through a simple reaction, if you have, like, atmospheric gases or whatever on that same moon, and you mine those, then people will steal the atmospheric gases, not the reaction product.
Okay.
So that's kind of dumb. One of the things that was suggested as a fix for that was the placement of the siphon determines what silo it's siphoning from.
I misread the dev blog. I read, I didn't realize that you could drop more than one. I thought it said you could not drop more than one, which now that seems a little screwy. You'd think it would be then like a percentage so that you could never totally cut out the actual POS owner's income.
Yeah, you can cut out the POS owner's income and trash a lot of it.
And because there's automatic waste, as soon as it pulls, you don't even have to successfully recover anything in the siphon to hurt them.
Yep. So you don't have to do anything other than shit this thing out and then leave. And that's the part that's dumb. It's not that it's going to hurt moon owners. Because, yeah, like you're saying, managing an R64 by logging on once a month and doing your little jump freighter roam over literally the entirety of the map is not good gameplay. And it's not productive gameplay. And it's not anything that I think the game needs more of. But this is shitting on the logistics guys. This is shitting on the people who own their space and live in it. And shitting on the small, you know, the small reaction farm runner, you know, that one weird industrialist you have in your corp who, you know, PvP's enough not to get kicked or whatever. So I don't think that overall the current design of Siphons is a good thing. I think the idea is sound. This is one of those ongoing conversations that's happening on the CSM.
Isn't that being released, though? Like, isn't that pretty close to release in the next patch?
So, Allie, how are those minutes going? Speaking of release.
I'm ignoring Alex. I'm going to talk to Freeze. It's scheduled for Rubicon. That doesn't mean that it is completely locked, and that doesn't mean that they can't make any changes to it. There were a couple of things for Odyssey that got changed reasonably significantly before release, based on CSM and player feedback.
Well, the problem is that the average player doesn't understand how 0-0 works, doesn't understand how 0-0 economics work. They don't understand that a single R64 fuels the gameplay for hundreds of players. Well, used to, a little bit less now. So the average Joe is going to ask, you know, when they asked about, well, how's the Siphon? They're going to be like, good, fuck those big alliances, damn the man. As we saw here today.
I mean, this is what the CSM is for, because the CSM does have people on it who understand the economics of large 0-0 alliances. That's kind of what we do, is have ideas and feedback that's generally
broader. So what's the CSM as a whole's policy on it?
I'm not sure if there's a CSM as a whole policy. I don't know what, say, Rip and Tag thinks. He's the one who I'd vote most likely to disagree with me. Mina has been quite publicly frustrated with them. I'm frustrated with them.
Zerf in the chat here is throwing out, like, it might be a boon to small alliances, and that might be a tack that people are taking, because small alliance could anchor it and then try to take ISK from a big alliance. Theoretically, yeah, but I don't see the way that's being implemented that that's really going to be a
likely thing.
The issue
is that it's not going to be used to take ISK. It's going to be used to grief you out of ISK. So it's going to be used as a tactic by large alliances to shut down the income stream of smaller alliances. So just like SBUs and iHubs and stuff like that were supposed to be a boon for small gang PvP, it's going to achieve the opposite of what CCP is intending.
I think most large alliances will just attack moons that they don't want other people to have, unless it's owned by another coalition. I think we're quite likely to do what you said, like send blockade runners throughout somebody's entire region and just anchor siphons on everything over and over again.
Yeah, why go invade Amencia when you can send three guys with the blockade runner to shut down its income? Now you don't have to deal with Amencia. And you can do that without actually actively campaigning against them, because three or four people would jerk off about how awesome it is.
And if you want an example of large alliances having an advantage over smaller alliances in terms of Siphon defense, all that you have to do as a large alliance is pay a bounty on Siphons killed, or draft your large number of players to do that. One of the problems that Sound has had as we do various different types of warfare has been burnout in because we don't have the redundancy in some leadership and logistics positions that larger alliances and coalitions do. And I think, you know, with logistics people already on the knife edge of burnout too many times, it's going to be something that's going to be harder for them to deal with.
All right, so I hate to break up a good conversation, but we're pushing time. So, like, let's just roll down the roster and I guess say, like, if you could change one thing about the Siphons, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about the Siphon, I wouldn't make it a structure you anchor. I'd make it a ship or something you put on a ship.
Allie?
I would do the thing where you get the 100% return upon killing it. I think it'd be better with the other two things that I suggested, but I'd much rather have the 100% return.
Freeze, you called me a fucking retard, but you're still a good guy. You want to answer?
I would spend more than 5 minutes at the chalkboard coming up with a dumbass thing to encourage small gang PvP that doesn't encourage small gang PvP.
And I would only let you drop one at a time on a pause, because not having a percentage stolen and then being able to stack them is a little like, hey, whoa now.
So let's get into the ending part of the podcast. This was something that Allie felt inspired to talk about based on trying to get sound into fleets with Noir and EMP and having some difficulty meeting some fitting standards. So this is a masterclass segment about Tech 1 versus Tech 2, and I presume that's both Tech 2 ships versus Tech 1 ships, as well as weapon systems.
I was thinking of it more as weapon systems, actually. Tech 1 versus Tech 2 ships is pretty well covered. I mean, we could talk about it if you want to, but there's a pretty clear advantage in picking a Tech 2 option. So the Tech 1 versus Tech 2 ship often comes down to do I have the money and the skill points to do this? And, you know, whether you're going to be fighting in a larger group or whether you want to be able to win outnumbered in a small group, or whether you want to, you know, flaunt your ISK for sort of the Tech 2 options, or whether you want more of a cheap, relaxed training gang, that's a good option for Tech 1, or you just are going to be blobbing. If you're going to be blobbing, there's not necessarily any need to go to Tech 2 ships.
Probably has something to do with your risk adversity, too. I mean, if you're, mm-hmm. like, a risk-adverse person, you're always going to take that into account, whereas if you don't really care about your killboard, I mean, you're going to be like, yeah, T2 all the way.
Yeah, for sure. So those, I mean, that ends up being the breakdown there. What I was interested in was actually Tech 1 weapons versus Tech 2 weapons. I came in talking to Alex about the options for sound pilots joining Noir fleets, and, you know, Noir had a number of Tech 2 fitted ships, or Tech 2 ships with the big one was Tech 2 Sentry drones, where sound pilots were looking at that and going, I can fly the ship, I can fly the tank. I have the T2 tank, I have the ship, I have reasonably good support skills, but unfortunately I do not have that weapon to T2. Can I still come to the fleet? And overwhelmingly, what we were hearing was no. So I guess, Alex, what is the case for Tech 2 over... Why take a Tech 2 weapon over a Tech 1 weapon?
Well, we never said no, they couldn't come, just don't come in that.
Most of the times it's range for the long-range ammo.
It's range, or sometimes it's just straight damage, where, especially, at least from my perspective, when you're dealing with like cruiser-sized fleets, where you're really scraping for DPS, and if you're missing like 20% of that DPS, because you don't have the Tech 2 guns, or you can't use the high-damage missiles, or whatever the case might be, then... You know, I could either have a player in one of those ships that's doing like a fifth of, or 4/5 of what it should do, or I could have him be like an interdictor or an interceptor for us or something like that that we need. And the range side of things is like, especially zealots, I know for sure. Trying to think of other fleets where you absolutely need Tech 2 ammo, like Oracle fleets. Basically, any kind of laser.
Vagabonds definitely need barrage.
There's a couple of cases where you're kiting in a Minmatar ship, so that's vagabonds. That's some stabbers, if you want to go for the cheap Tech 1 option there.
Abby mentions the Talos. He's absolutely right with that one.
Yeah, the Talos, and certainly the Oracle, the Zealot, really any... A Mars ship with lasers is usually going to have a Tech 2 fit. But I don't necessarily get it for railguns, for projectiles outside of those specialized situations. Because most of the time when I'm in an engagement, and this might be a failing of me as a pilot, I end up trying to stay inside of a range where my Tech 1 ammo, both the shorter and longer range variants that I have in my hold, is going to work out for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always an ammo that'll get you out to the Tech 2 ammo range. Like, you could use, what is it, radio, I think, for Amar. You'll hit out to the Scorch range. You'll just do a quarter of the damage.
You'll hit out well past Scorch range.
Yeah, you just won't do anything.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
It'll be like shining a flashlight on the enemy and calling it a laser beam.
I'm thinking for railguns, I don't tend to use Spike or Javelin. Tends to be, Kaldari Navy Antimatter, Kaldari Navy Thorium. For blasters, similarly, it's almost entirely antimatter, although, given the range-closing issues with blasters, having access to Null has improved my application somewhat. I looked up the DPS for a Rail Brutix. If you go from Tech 2 to Tech 1 guns, Sound has a rail fit that's, I think, quite similar to Insidious Empire's. Tech 2 guns are 674 DPS, Tech 1 are 620. So I'm not seeing it make that much of a difference in those situations.
It only does in terms of certain engagements. Like, if you're using it at close range for 90% of the time, then yeah, it's not a big deal. But if you are fighting something silly like a T3 BC gang where they're trying to burn through you and burn away, if you have Spike loaded, you can alpha just a shit ton of them while they do that. Whereas if you have the T1 version, if they get past 50-60, you're just not really contributing. But again, it's very situational awareness. Railguns, unless you're on a railgun platform that the range bonuses are a factor, so say like the Eagle, where you're really trying to hit out at extreme long range, or maybe a Tengu. If you can fly a Tengu, but you can fly the Tech 2 guns, you're already in trouble. But for most of the T1 ones, like our MOA fleets or whatever that we use mostly for digging around, doesn't really matter. The T1 guns work just as fine.
You'll see Spike 2 in rails.
Yeah. On your Eagles, if you do Tech 1 guns, it's like a 30 DPS loss.
That doesn't sound like that much, though.
But it's just on the range factor. Yeah. Just on the range factor at the end of the day. Depending on your fit again, though, because the Eagle can hit out to like 200k, but you still have the targeting range issues.
So what are the... There comes a point at which you can say, alright, well, don't... you can come, but don't come in that. At what point, Ice Alex and Freeze, at what point do you start taking a... E-warship or a logistic ship or an interdictor or an interceptor, sort of a support ship, at what point is it more worth it to you to have a weaker DPS ship versus a potentially better support ship? Because there is such a thing as a fleet with too much support. Oh, alright, and Turtle. Turtle can answer too.
I'll let Freeze lead that off because I think he's got a little more experience managing pilots of different SP levels.
The problem is if you give them a low skill point, low cost ship that they can go in, most pilots are shitheads and they will fly that every time even though they have 90 million skill point and can fly the T2 versions, no sweat. So that's your big issue. So you kind of have to gauge that on a fleet by fleet basis. Like, as an example, we're trying to do Eagle fleets, but we ran smack dab into the middle of a skill point issue. So we have 30 people in Eagles and 80 in MOAs. And when we first started running, that was about a month ago, and the directive was to train Caldari Cruiser, or no, train Tech 2 medium rails first, and then to train Caldari Cruiser 5. So ostensibly, there should have been a certain point where the vast majority of pilots clicked into having the T2 guns, which improves the range a little bit. Still not as much, obviously, because it's a MOA. It doesn't have the range bonuses that an Eagle does. But you just kind of got to gauge it. And it also depends on what you're fighting. So if you're fighting something where you need an engagement range of 70 to 80 kilometers and the T1 variant just simply can't hit at that range, either you need to change to a different ship type or get them into support. I mean, you can always use more logistics. You can always use more E-War. I mean, if you do have such that you have almost no DPS because nobody can fly the Tech 2 variant, then you probably should reevaluate what doctrine you're flying in that situation. It's a lame answer, but it all comes down to situational awareness and, you know, what you're fighting.
Yeah, I think he's pretty much right there, and it does come down to that. If you're so strapped that you can't have a decent fleet core, then you need to reevaluate the doctrine itself. And I've done that not terribly recently, but a few times I can remember where I've looked at a fleet and I've tried to take out like a certain kind of fleet type, and I just didn't have enough people that could possibly do it, and I had to rethink the plan for that roam. Like a year or two ago, maybe I was trying to do like a zealot roam, and I had 15 dudes, but only 3 of them could fly zealots with tech 2 guns. That's not enough. Like, I had 3 guardians, and those 3, and then a bunch of just crap. And so I was like, all right, well, that's obviously not going to happen. So I looked into, can we do like a shield thing? Can we do assault frigates? Looking at better options so you can have a solid core that you can work with and call targets around.
Well, you guys both like kind of hit it on the head, I think, and you hinted at it. It's like the fleet comps, the doctrines, they have like a purpose. They have an objective with whether it's how far the ship can shoot or if it's, you know, something like an AHAC, which is high durability, low SIG radius. Like, your fleets have a purpose, and if pilots aren't fitting that purpose, they're a detriment to that purpose. So, like, yeah, if you can't fly a zealot, you know, bring whatever ancillary ships you're going to need, but, like, it is super situational. You always have to look at what people can bring, and does that fit into the purpose? Because, I mean, yeah, maybe you do bring a zealot fleet that's only got, like, 4 out of 10 people in zealots, but if those other 6 people are where they need to be, like, that fleet can still be effective.
I think it ultimately comes down, at least at the small gang level, if you have enough DPS ships that you're confident you can kill a fleet of the same opposing size. So if I'm running a 20-man armor hack fleet, if I run into another 20-man fleet, do I have enough DPS to break their logistics? Do I have enough logistics to tank their damage?
Or enough E-War to neutralize their logistics in the first place.
Exactly. And if I don't have enough damage electronic warfare combination, and the guy is like, well, I could be your 21st guy in this zealot that has, like, second best name guns, or the sacrilege that can't use high-yield missiles, or I can come in a Celestis, or I can come in a tackler, or I can come in a logistic ship. Most likely, they're probably more valuable, like the value per pilot in one of those other ships.
Even though you're short on the DPS to meet your objective with that fleet.
I was saying, if I do have enough DPS, like an extra zealot with not really that great guns, or I could get some more utility in the fleet, or some more logistics, or some more tackle so I can catch stuff. If I don't have enough DPS, then you're sort of faced with a pretty tough choice, because if you open that up to too many pilots, then you really have to make some hard decisions when you're FCing, because you can't count on the fact that all your zealots can hit out to a certain range, or you can't count on the fact that your 20 people in fleet is doing the damage you think 20 people should be doing. And then you might take fights that you can't actually win, or you might get into a situation where you're calling targets that you can't break because half your DPS can't hit that. So for us, it's easier just to say, if you can't do the damage and hit at the ranges that we expect a ship that's fit like this to hit at, don't come in that ship. It's just easier for the FCs.
Makes sense. I know Providence has had historically issues with this, historically issues with creating a doctrine that was not very accessible. It seems like their current sentry blob thing is at least getting more people into approximately the same kind of engagement range.
Yeah, their problem is that
a lot of the sentry ships look the same.
The profs and the vexers don't have that real range to reach out and touch somebody, so their wheelhouse is about 50 kilometers, and most everyone that they end up engaging is hitting out past there. So they kind of warp on grid, get hazed, then run away and hide in a pause for 3 hours until they either go away or someone comes to save them.
Well, if you want to talk value per ship, having prophecies and vexers with sentry drones. Not that great.
Why is it?
Because the damage per second of, what, 3 sentries is, I think, what they can field, compared if they were, like, doing a full complement of 5 drones, a mix of heavies, mediums, and lights. They're giving up a lot of DPS. They're leaving it on the table. They're doing
if they were flying Dominixes, then they'd be fine, but they would lose all their Dominixes in the first 5 minutes to bombers, so we've gone full circle, I guess.
Yep. But, I mean, there are plenty of, like, when I say don't come in that, there are plenty of ships that, you know, a lower skill point pilot can fly that work out just fine. You know, it's, for Noir's point of view, it's that, you know, your ship needs to be able to do what it says on the tin. And if it can't, then you're sort of doing a disservice to your fleet. And you're flying a big ticket ship that's not taking advantage of why it costs so much.
You know, even if what you're flying turns out to be a medium ticket ship, like a battle cruiser or whatever.
I don't know. T2 guns are like cheap enough where if you have the skills, you should just be using them. I mean, realistically, like it's a hard comparison between T1 and T2 guns and like T1 and T2 ships. Because yeah, there's definitely times you shouldn't be bringing T2 ships, but like. Really, when you get right down to it, like the price point of a Tech 2 autocannon over its Metaphor variant, like, definitely worth the investment.
And the Metaphors are actually kind of expensive, some of them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you fit those on things that you can't fit the T2 guns to. So, I mean, I'm not talking about, I would never even consider taking T1 guns, given that someone has T2, unless I'm doing some weird, whack-ass tank thing. It's more a question of just the utility of T2 weapons over T1 as it applies to fitting your lower skilled people into your fleets. And it's sounding like the consensus here is mostly design a different fleet if that's going to be a problem for you.
Design a different fleet if you can't work them into like the existing fleet comp. But, I mean, you always want to take that pilot. You're never going to be like, no, go home, log off. Like, fuck you.
Unless you're CBA. Unless you're CBA, they said that.
I, like, don't even know how to respond to that.
CVA.
Yeah, Pravi Logic.
Pravi Logic.
But it's weird, like...
It's like The Shining, where you just turn crazier and crazier the longer you're there.
So, like, the real interesting question, I think, at least from the Noir point of view and the ships that we run, comes in on the Sacrilege, because the Sacrilege does not have, like, any particular range that you need to hit at. It's not like a Zealot where if you don't have detect your range ammo, you're not going to hit the primaries at all. The issue with the Sacrilege is if you're not using the Tech 2 missiles, you can't use the Tech 2 close range ammo, which the Sac needs for damage if it's fighting anything that's not another cruiser. So if it's fighting a battle cruiser or something bigger, you want that Tech 2 missile ammo to be putting out the damage application. And if you compare Metaphor faction ammo to Tech 2 heavy ammo, it's a pretty significant damage difference. So this pilot can clearly fly Amar cruisers, he just can't fly the weapon system. Like, I almost feel it would be better to have that pilot in like an Arbitrator, assuming he could use Tech 2 drones, which hopefully could. And then he doesn't need to use Tech 2 high slots to do anything. He can use tracking disruptors and be really useful to the fleet and still put out some damage with his drones as well. Won't tank as well, but his entire ship costs 1/5 to 1/6 of what the Sacrilege will cost. So if he dies, okay.
So it kind of sounds just like balancing price point versus... helpfulness to the fleet. I think if you had
pretty
to sum
much.
It all up.
Yeah. I mean, I get that it... You also gotta keep in mind, Noro's always coming from this from a pretty small gang perspective, but we need to make the most out of, like, the 10, 15, 20, 25 pilots that we have. Whereas, you know, someone like an FC like Freeze... He knows that he's going to have, like, 50 to 100 to 150 pilots in his fleets on any given day. So
he has a lot more room for error.
Right, for his perspective, it's more like he's got to keep in mind the logistics of it, you know, getting the number of players that he needs into that so he has enough to alpha off whoever it is. But at our level, we rarely have enough damage to straight alpha strike anybody, so that damage per second actually does matter quite a bit. And also at our level, like, electronic warfare and tackle play a bit of a greater role, whereas I think at the larger levels, you start to see stuff like dampening and tractor disrupting and ECM still, they're still present, but they're not as pivotal because you've got more players to try to do that to, and it's hard to coordinate electronic warfare. DPS and Alpha Strike seems to be more the king of the 0-0 fleet fight.
Certainly easier if you can make the other guy explode faster than you're exploding.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Allie, does that sort of get out of that discussion what you were hoping for?
Yeah, it clarifies it a little bit, and it clarifies it a little bit in terms of, you know, how it's instructional in terms of building fleets so that you can either building fleets so that you can incorporate for my use, which is of course running Alliance, which is always going to have a small influx of low skilled players, running fleets so that you can bring those people in, and you can bring them in a way that's interesting. It's important that not only is it just fly tackle, but going beyond that to, you know, E-War or even kind of a certain introductory DPS or whatever.
I have the Tech 1 logistics cruisers are incredible return for as SP on a fleet. I mean, they're good.
They nerfed them a bit. They're still good.
They're still good. I think the math is like they're, what, 2/3 of a logistics cruiser? Or 3/4? Something like that.
Yeah, they die a lot faster than a logistics cruiser, which is the big the big thing that when you're... I was giving a little bit of speech on your comms about this, about, you know, taking engagements with T2 versus T1 Logi. You can't really just alpha the T2 Logi off the field the same way as you can on the T1.
Yeah, which makes them, in some ways, a bit of a double-edged sword, in that you think you have much more logistics than you actually have, because they can get punched through pretty quickly.
On the other hand, buffs the T2 when the other guy looks at it and goes, oh, it's just 2 Logis, I can take care of that, no problem.
Yeah, I would say, on the other hand, it's, if you can keep it up, like, it's probably the most pivotal thing a low SP pilot could be doing. Because it doesn't take an awful lot of SP to get in them or get the reppers for them. So you don't need a lot of investment to do something really pivotal for the fleet.
And a lot of that investment is support skills that you really want anyway.
But Arbys and Celestuses are pretty badass too. I would love to do the fuck you fleet that Test was doing. I think it was Test. It might have been CFC.
CFC.
It was CFC.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. An entire fleet of Celestuses. Just like the 200 of them.
We've joked about running around with, like, a Blackbird and logistics ship, Blackbird and logistics fleet, and jumping into other people's fights and just being like, alright guys, break it up, break it up, break it up. Rep and jam both sides.
Alright guys, let's close this one out. This has been Declarations of War 61. Go to declarationsofwar.com to participate in the show poll, leave a comment, or put in a donation. We have a new donation button that looks pretty swag. Click it, check it out. Also, check out our store. You can click that link on the site as well, www.welovefine.com/eve. You can reach Noir via our public channel, Cafe Noir. And apply to join us or Noir Academy in the forums at noirmerch.com. And as of this episode, we are available for contracts in November. So if you are looking to get something started, or you need to take revenge on somebody, or you have a special project in mind, give us a ring. There's a pretty nice opening between now, when this podcast is likely to be released, and Rubicon, where we're probably going to be super busy in HiSec cleaning up Pocos. Because, yeah, every day I get about 6 mails on that, so... I assume some of those people will be able to pay. But, fingers crossed on that one. Well, take it easy, guys. Fly safe and good hunting.
vote Jeff Rader 2013.
I'm cutting that out, asshole.
Bastard.
Bright lights keep streaming. Feels like looking in a magazine. You hurt on the floor. Feels like dancing is the way to go. But if you let her see that man say, look, look, sure that you're not that shy. Let her see that man say, look, look, sure you're that type. Young boy, don't be late. This girl ain't really got time to wait. You think it's all for show, but this is just the only way I know. But if you let her see that man say, look, look, sure that you're not that shy.